Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This edition of Soundcheck was first broadcast in September 2004. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Opera, it's a messy business. All that unrequited love and lust and murder and more lust and more murder. Well, we are going to take a look at a couple of very different operatic projects on the program today. In the second half of our program, we'll be taking a look at Giuseppe Verdi's Otello, his reworking of Shakespeare's Othello, considered by some to be perhaps the greatest operatic or even musical setting, in a more generic sense, of the writings of Shakespeare. But to begin, take the ugliest man in the world, watch him fall in love with the leading actress in a TV thriller, and wait for the hilarity to ensue. That is the basis of a new road opera being presented by the Nine Circle Chamber Theater, an organization that seems devoted to doing the strange and even stranger in music and theater. They are occasional guests of ours on Soundcheck, and their latest satire is called Buwalski, a road opera. The production's composer is Mel Marvin. Their librettist is Jonathan Levi, and it's great to have them back here in the studio. Jonathan, you're not just the librettist, but a co-founder of the Nine Circles Chamber Theater.
That's right. No, it's great to be back.
Good to have you here. Mel Marvin joining us for the first time on Soundcheck. Mel, that was some of your music we were just listening to.
It was, John. I'm delighted to be here as well.
Okay. Now, Jonathan, who is Buwalski? What's the provenance of this story of yours?
Well, the provenance, the opera was commissioned by a wonderful, wild and wacky Dutch company called Opera Spanga, which produces operas in the middle of cow pastures, in convents, in townhouses around Holland, and pulls in audiences from all over Europe.
Boy, talk about messy. An opera in the middle of a cow field.
Well, it's got smell-o-vision in it, you can imagine, as part of the whole effect. Uh-huh. But the provenance is that the director of Opera Spanga and the director of this opera, Carina van Eyck, came to me with an unproduced screenplay by another wild and wacky Dutch director and said to me, do you think this opera about the ugliest man in the world, who, however, has a pair of hands that drive women crazy with lust, do you think that could be turned into an opera?
And it sounds like a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, and so, clearly, since I think that, and most people agree with me, that Seinfeld is opera, I said, absolutely.
But whereas Seinfeld might be an opera about nothing, this is an opera about something.
Well, inevitably, we like to get our hands on these things and play around with some of the ideas. And the something that it's about, in addition to being about how people abuse each other, and even the ugliest man in the world, who might find himself very fortunate that women want him to do manual labor, in fact becomes a victim as much as any woman, and in this case the most beautiful woman in the world, who is desired by everybody, is abused for her beauty.
Mm-hmm. So now, is this, you said this was originally an unproduced screenplay. There is a film element to this road opera of yours, isn't it?
Absolutely. Carina, in many of her recent operas, and most notably a production of Rigoletto that she filmed as the first opera film in Holland, has been increasingly attracted to film. So when she came and talked to me about turning this screenplay into an opera, I said, only if we can do more with film. Hmm. Only if we've got, if we use TV and screens and have a lot of fun.
Well, now, Mel, as the composer, are you writing then for live singers who are up on stage plus writing for maybe those same people pre-recorded on film?
Actually, the interludes, which are on film, are played by an orchestra, by a full orchestra, and there's no singing in them. The piece was written by John. It was actually John's idea to write the piece in the same sort of format as Wozzeck. so that we have
the opera by Alban
Berg. Yes, so that there are scenes, sung scenes, and then orchestral interludes. But in this case, the orchestral interludes are film sequences. So they are, but the singers, the actual singers on stage, are the same people in the film. They just don't sing. It's all done orchestrally.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the orchestral versions of it and taped all of that in a studio in Holland last March. And then there's a smaller jazz-oriented orchestra, which
does
plays
the
for the live action. Yeah.
Which makes logistical sense. I mean, Nine Circles is a chamber theater. It'd be hard to fit a full symphony orchestra into the pit there.
Yeah.
The last time Nine Circles was here, you guys were doing a production of Samson and Delilah, in which the role of Samson was played by a violin.
Mm-hmm.
Not a violinist, but by the violin itself. I mean, Gil Morgenstern was playing it, but you know, it was sort of an instrumental lead singer, if you will.
Exactly. And for that production, the Delilah was a Dutch soprano, Clara Ullman, and the director was, in fact, Opera Spanga's Carina van Eyck. And that was, in a way, our first collaboration, our first toe in the water with Opera Spanga. And, you know, the toe came out and felt pretty good. And so we decided to continue.
So you dove in.
Absolutely.
All right. So now that was strange enough, the idea of your lead character being played by a violin. How does Mel's music and your narrative come together in this new work, in the
opera
Bowalski?
Well, the strangest way in this, in which it works here, is that, as Mel mentioned, the world of Lada, the world of this beautiful woman in her thriller where she's on the run from the inspector along with her lover of indeterminate international background, Franco, that Bowalski, of course, being attacked as he is by all the women, retreats into a fantasy world in which he, in fact, does meet Lada, and she comes down off the screen, and things go, of course, very well for a while, as they do in opera, and then as they do in opera, they go horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And what Carina has done quite expertly with her film crew and also with her cast is integrate these interludes and these scenes so that, in fact, the actors do come out of the film onto the stage and back onto it again in many, many clever variations.
Hmm.
Over the course of 90 minutes, any imaginable combination you can want to see is there on stage.
So the character of Lada looks like she's actually up on the screen in the film, but then she's actually mysteriously appearing live.
She appears, and she appears in the same costume, in fact. So one thing, or you see a hospital bed being rolled down a corridor, and suddenly it's rolled onto the stage.
And the same thing with Mel's music, that the orchestral, the fully orchestrated stuff on the screen melds, you know, seamlessly into the jazz ensemble on stage.
All right. So what is the, Mel, what is the makeup of the pit band for this program?
Well, let's see if I can do this. There's a great realm of percussion covering about half the pit.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the pit is occupied by contrabass, violin, cello, trumpet, trombone, and a man who plays both tenor and alto sax and clarinet.
Okay. So basically three winds, three strings, and a huge arsenal of percussion.
Yep.
And how many singers do we have? Total.
Oh, we've got a total of five singers mm-hmm. up on stage. We've got Lada, her lover Franco, the inspector they're running from, Bowalski, and then finally one woman who plays every single other woman, who we call every woman on stage.
So I guess there's a lot of playing of fantasy and reality, because Lada is a fantasy character. I mean, she's in a TV show, right? She's acting out a TV show that he's watching.
No, absolutely, and it's one of the fun things that I think that opera and film, when you marry them together, can do, because the tradition of opera is certainly one of fantasy, as can be the one of film, but we've started to believe so much, you know, through reality TV, that what we're seeing there up on the screen is what's really happening, that, you know, that line is crossed, I think, daily.
Interesting point. Yeah.
And I think in this piece, it's actually crossed and recrossed in mm-hmm. a number of directions so that it becomes more and more complex.
All right. So what's happening at the end of Act One, which we're about to hear?
Well, what's happened here is that Bowalski, in trying to do a mundane clerical errand, has run across what he thinks, in fact, is Lada. And he goes home and he turns on his TV set and he hears her sing to him. And as a result, singing, "Come Help Me." And so he runs back down to his office. He works at a police station. He runs into his office, and who's there but the inspector? From the TV show.
Okay.
Who starts to taunt him because he's come looking for Lada, and the inspector says, "You think you can have a woman like Lada? You know, a man as ugly as you?" And, you know, Bowalski becomes more and more infuriated and then finally confused because who steps out of the bathroom toweling her hair but Lada? They're between takes, after all. She doesn't know who he is. And the inspector is laughing. He turns around, stabs the inspector. Lada faints. End of Act One.
All right. Here it is from Bowalski, a road opera. The composer is Mel Marvin. The librettist is Jonathan Levi. They are both my guests on Soundcheck. That's just an excerpt from the end of Act One of Bowalski, a road opera being presented by the Nine Circles Chamber Theater. The composer is Mel Marvin. The librettist is Jonathan Levi, who's one of the co-founders of the Nine Circles Chamber Theater. And Mel is a kind of a Peter Gunn Mannix kind of thing happening there in the music.
Oh, there are sort of references to God knows how many things. There are little bows, I think, in a couple of ways to Mingus and Miles Davis in the piece. But it was an interesting, because I'm not, this is actually the first jazz opera I have composed in a long form. It was a decision made directly, actually, looking at writing a piece about pop culture for opera singers. Faced with that challenge, I think one doesn't necessarily go into contemporary pop genre stuff when opera singers are going to do it. So I looked at a way of finding a combination of jazz and with some classical gestures in it that also was able to cross the boundaries that jazz and classical music have traditionally crossed.
Well, and if you think of, you know, some of those old TV thriller themes, they were written by composers who were pretty conversant in both orchestral music and jazz.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you look at some of the composers who are doing film scores as well, there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah. So. Jonathan, why is it called Bowalski a road opera?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I've got the entire answer to, but it has to do with translation. That when I was working with Karina on this, that in her mind, what we were doing with the interludes was we were taking the characters out of the theater, out of a space, and out onto the road. At the same time, what a road opera said to me is it sort of said Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and, you know, The Road to Friesland or, you know, something of this sort. And I think that also, you know, participated a little bit in terms of Mel and my thinking of this, you know, within this kind of, you know, film noir moves into the Man from U.N.C.L.E. kind of genre.
Yeah. I didn't know that was a genre.
it's a little known but rising one.
Very narrow genre. We're speaking both with composer Mel Marvin and librettist Jonathan Levi. Now, the recording we just heard, that excerpt, that was done live.
Yes.
At a performance in Holland, which raises the question of, you know, differences in audiences, in approach, in what theater companies can and cannot do on either side of the Atlantic. And we will pose some of those questions to our guests in just a moment as we continue with Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. We're speaking with composer Mel Marvin and librettist, novelist, writer, and Performing Arts Center director Jonathan Levi about their collaboration on Buwalski, a road opera, which is being presented by the Nine Circles Chamber Theater. Jonathan, you also run the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts at Bard College.
That's right. Up until this last August, I've now just left.
Okay.
After two seasons there.
But you were there this summer for the Shostakovich Festival. Lots of music theater, and his music theater could be very satirical stuff.
Oh, absolutely. We did a production of his Nose.
The Nose.
Opera, The Nose.
Right.
Yes. you know, based on the story by Gogol.
Right.
And boy, there was satire there.
Mm-hmm. So in that respect, maybe Buwalski cut from the same satiric cloth as Gogol / Shostakovich?
I'd like to think that somehow there's a direct relation all the way back to Gogol. I mean, Dostoevsky said that all of us come out of Gogol's overcoat. And, you know, it's like nice to think that my great-great-grandfather who came out of Russia maybe also – maybe he patched that overcoat a little bit, but that the kind of sensibility that that Gogol had and that Shostakovich, you know, picked up on, especially in his earlier years, is something that helped define the 20th century. The feeling that somehow we can't quite look at reality without with an unjaundiced eye.
Yeah, and it helps to maintain a sense of humor and perhaps a dispassionate, you know, sense about what you see around you at times. Now, this is a chamber opera. I mean, Nine Circles is a chamber theater group. Mm-hmm. Could this have been a grand opera if, by some fluke, there were a grand opera house actually willing to produce it?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because Mel and I this summer did write another opera, Guest from the Future, which Nine Circles also developed for 12 singers and nine musicians based on the story of the Russian poet Anna Akhmatova and the British philosopher Isaiah Berlin. In that case, I would say absolutely that there's a piece in which the orchestra could be expanded, we could hire in a chorus, the thing could become big and even more Russian than it was.
And it was an exercise in paring down, in fact, to do that production
right,
the way we did it.
But there was something, I think, very sui generis about doing this thing with opera Spanga, and not with the accent on sui too much with the farmland, but that the collaboration with Carina really was one in which this opera was written for this number of forces and specifically for her company. She's worked with these singers for a long time. They're as much actors as they are singers, and that's clearly key. So I would say no, it's the size that it is for a very good reason.
And it's all 1, 2, and 3 character scenes.
Mm-hmm.
The largeness of it appears really in the interludes, which are on film, so they're already contained. So what's on the stage is very, very much what we intended, and I think it doesn't need expansion and can't hold it, actually.
And as you say, the large parts being on film sort of divorces them from the reality of what's happening
on
stage.
Well, in a sense, although we have to think about how to balance everything out with the sound of the orchestra and the sound of the film, and do we want the film to be much louder or the orchestra to be the same? You know, it's a complicated.
Well, but that word divorce, I think, is key to it. When you talk about, you know, when we talk about its provenance being Wozzeck, a character, you know, a private who was abused in his own army and was very much detached from his own detachment. And, you know, that comes out of the same time as Gogol, as a matter of fact, the original story.
So is there something European? I mean, is there a European sensibility about Opera Spagna, the Dutch company this was written for?
Very much so. This is an extremely European production. It's been very interesting to watch how and of course, the collaboration continued through the process. So we became more European as it took on its own force.
Speaking random European languages?
Well, let me tell you, in the rehearsal period, we were speaking five languages. You know, there are all these different forces, even though they're singing in English. It was amazing. And there are a couple of people in the company who speak no English. Their English sounds quite good.
Well, there was one case, as a matter of fact, one instruction that I had in libretto, which was that Lotta was in the style of a film noir thriller. When Karina finally showed me the rushes in a tiny, cramped Amsterdam hotel, and I saw these of the TV series. You know, I saw all these bright pastels in daytime, and I said to Karina, but I said film noir, you know, in there. And she said, yes, I wasn't quite sure what you meant by film noir. So, you know, immediately the translation, you know, went somewhat askew, but askew for the better, I've got to say.
Actually, one of my favorite remarks made about the opera was someone who called it daytime noir.
Very nice. Day-glow noir.
Well, actually, yes.
So, you know, if this were, I mean, you know, if this were done in America specifically for an American company, do you think it would have turned out differently?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the wonderful things. I mean, certainly, you know, Mel and I, and I think Karina as well, you know, would be very curious to see someone else take a crack at this. Because part of the nature, and especially with the film, is that they'd have to take a crack at that. And their whole take on what it would mean, you know, where they're pulling their own TV knowledge from, you know, would have an impact on it.
Right. So, I mean, I guess this goes back to one of the basics of creating opera. You have a librettist who writes the story. You have the composer who writes the music. But then the third part of this triumvirate, in this case, it's Karina van Eyck, but it could be anybody else. The person who directs it, who decides what it's going to look like, what your show is going to be. You know, and we've seen this in the opera field, that very often a director can take a beloved old opera and without changing a word or a note, create something completely different out of it through a different production.
I think the remarkable thing in this case is that Karina did this with a living librettist and a living composer and didn't kill them.
Well, you know, there's
or vice versa.
Yeah. There is certainly an awful lot of, you know, hand-wringing done, you know, on both sides when you have living artists sort of in a collaborative effort. We're going to be looking in the second half at Verdi taking on Shakespeare. And, of course, he had the advantage/disadvantage of working with a writer who had been long dead by the time he got to his libretto to working on the play. So I guess that's a completely different thing. We call it opera, but what you guys have created seems to be, you know, completely different.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think, you know, Verdi certainly in his time was looking at these old subjects, and if we say that we're looking back at, you know, the origins of this kind of absurdity, which goes back to the 19th century, he was looking at it and making it very contemporary. And I think that and my guess is that's what most librettists and most composers and finally most directors really want to make is make it immediate to their audience.
Right. Okay.
And you started out by saying it was lust, blood, and murder, and our opera certainly is.
And as we all know, that's pretty much Othello boiled down to a nutshell as well.
Right. A black comedy.
But we will take a closer look at Verdi's Othello, both on film, on stage, and at the opera, in the second half of our program. But let me first thank the principals of Buwalski, a road opera from the Nine Circles Chamber Theater, Jonathan Levi, the librettist, Mel Marvin, the composer. Jonathan, Mel, thank you both for joining us, and good luck with the run of shows this week.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks very John. Much.
This is Soundcheck, a broadcast originally heard in September 2004.